Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 9:02 a.m., January 18th, 2024. With me today is Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, Senator Wilson, and myself, Stedman. We have a full contingent today. We're going to have a discussion and a presentation on revenue and revenue forecasts and the differences that are taking place. So those that have watched this before, there'll be a little different twist through today as the economics and expenditures have changed in the basin, mainly dealing with Willow and other things. So we'll touch on some of that. So it'll be a little bit different. With that, I'd like to go ahead and ask the commissioner to come forward, Commissioner Revenue, Mr. Adam Crum. He's got a contingent backup. I'll let him bring up who he wants to have assist him in this presentation.
Hey, good morning, committee. Thank you so much for inviting us here today. I'm Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Today, we're going to be doing the Fall 23 forecast presentation of our anticipated revenues into the state. Leading the presentation is going to be Dan Stickle, the Chief Economist for the Economic Research Group within the Division of Tax. And so he's going to come up and he'll lead this presentation, and we'll be available for questions throughout. Also, I'd like to introduce in the room is Acting Tax Director Brandon Spanos, extensive experience with the Division of Tax as well as prior experience with the IRS as well. So we have got good leadership there in the tax division as we continue to look at this and have these good conversations throughout session with the legislature.
Mr. Stickle, you are not a fresh face to the committee, so good to see you back. We'll have you, when you go through your presentation, delve into Willow a little bit, the per barrel credit, if you could, a little bit, touch on some of that stuff. And then the normal revenue stuff that you normally talk about.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. And pertaining to Willow, we do have a white paper and presentation that we put together last year based on the spring forecast. That's something that's available on the Tax Division website. We are in the process of updating that with fall forecast information, so we'd be happy to come back at a future date with a more in-depth discussion into that topic. It would be helpful.
Okay.
So jump into the presentation. Slide two is just an agenda for the presentation. It's broken into three sections. First is some background on the revenue forecast generally and some of the key assumptions. And then we walk through the overall revenue forecast numbers, first looking at total state revenue and then diving into the unrestricted general fund revenue, which is the subject of most of the budget debates. And then towards the back part of the presentation, we have additional detail on the assumptions around the petroleum revenue forecast. So on slide four, the fall revenue forecast was published in mid-December in the Revenue Sources Book, sometimes referred to as the RSB. And that is the revenue forecast that forms the basis for the governor's budget proposal. And then we also do a spring update in a couple of months. That typically comes out in March or early April, and that will contain a updated set of revenue forecast assumptions to help with final budget decisions. And the RSB does fill a statutory requirement that the governor provide a revenue forecast as well as a forecast to underlie the 10-year plan that comes out of the Office of Management and Budget. And all of our revenue forecasts going back for decades can be found on our website at tax.alaska.gov. I'm on slide five now and want to kind of reiterate, as we always do, that our forecast is one discrete scenario within a range of potential outcomes, and always subject to potential uncertainty. So this slide outlines the key assumptions that are included into the fall revenue forecast. For investments, we assume a 7.45% annual return for the permanent fund for the remainder of fiscal year 2024, and then a 7.2% annual return for fiscal year 2025. And this is something that will come up later in the presentation. For the 2024 forecast of investments, we use actual data through the end of October, and then plus the 7.45% for the remainder of the fiscal year. And returns through the end of October were rather poor, and actual returns for November and December have been very strong. So if we were to do the investment forecast today, we'd actually be looking at a more robust investment revenue for fiscal year 24 in particular. Looking at federal revenue, we've incorporated all known stimulus funding through December of 2023. This includes all of the COVID-related funding, the Infrastructure Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and we've worked closely with OMB for those estimates. The petroleum revenue forecast is based on a oil price of $82.39 per barrel for fiscal year 2024, $76 per barrel for fiscal year 2025, and then we follow the futures market projections for our price forecast, and that has prices decreasing over the next few years and then stabilizing around $70 per barrel by the end of the forecast period. Looking at non-petroleum revenue, we're forecasting stable and continued economic growth, so we are not looking for any sort of recession or anything like that. For cruise ships, we're basing our tourism forecast on 1.64 million annual visitors, so very similar to last year's record levels. Fishing industry is one that we had some discussions around going into the forecast. 2023 was a very poor year for fisheries values and fisheries prices. We have a rather naive assumption. We're assuming a three-year recovery time period for the fisheries industry in that forecast. And then for mining industry, our price outlook there is based on futures market projections. Slide 6 is a graphic depiction of the relative importance of different state revenue sources for fiscal year 2023. Revenue to the state is really a three-legged stool, so it's federal investment and petroleum are the three primary sources of total revenue to the state, as Alaska does not have a statewide sales or income tax at the personal level. And while industries outside of these three key drivers are important to the economy of the state, they're relatively small in terms of revenue. Everything outside of federal investment and petroleum amounted to about 7.4% of total state revenue in fiscal year 2023. And then slide 7 is a similar depiction for our forecast for fiscal year 2024. Again, those top three sources of federal petroleum investment collectively estimated to provide a little over 89% of total state revenue. Federal revenue is always significant, but with the various spending packages, it is expected to be nearly half of total state revenue in fiscal year 2024. And then all other revenue sources at a little over 10%. So slide 9 starts to put some numbers up on the screen. This slide summarizes some of the key changes to the unrestricted revenue forecast between our current fall forecast and our prior spring 2023 forecast that was released in March of 2023. For oil prices, our forecast of Alaska North Slope oil prices was increased by $9.39 per barrel for fiscal year 2024. And by $6 per barrel for fiscal year 2025. And those increases reflect updated information from futures markets and the most recent market activity. For the permanent fund transfer, there was a small decrease to the fiscal year 2025 forecast based on the final performance for fiscal year 2023. And then that permanent fund transfer for fiscal year 2025, that's a known number at this point for budget purposes. In terms of total unrestricted revenue, our fiscal year 2024 forecast was increased by $228 million. And then our fiscal year 2025 forecast was increased by about $87 million. And the higher oil price was the primary reason for those increases, slightly offset by lower oil production and higher company spending. But the higher oil price was the driver for the increase to the revenue forecast. Slide 10 shows total state revenue from all sources for fiscal year 2023, and then our forecast for fiscal year 2024 and 2025. In the revenue forecast in the budget, revenues are broken down into four categories of restriction for budget purposes. The unrestricted general fund revenues are those revenues that can be appropriated by the legislature for any purpose, and those are when we're discussing revenues and budgets, a lot of times that's the focus of the discussion, since those can have the freest ability to be appropriated. Designated general funds are revenues that are technically available for appropriation, but they're customarily appropriated for some specific purpose. So an example of that is a portion of the state's alcohol tax revenue that is customarily appropriated to alcohol and drug abuse treatment and prevention purposes. The other restricted revenues, those are revenues that really are dedicated in some way to how they must be used, and they're truly not available for general appropriation. So an example there would be the constitutional dedication of a portion of royalties to the permanent fund. And then finally, we consider all federal revenues as restricted revenues. Those must be used for specific purposes attached to the transfer of the money to the state. So for fiscal year 2023, total state revenue from all sources was about $15.5 billion, and we're forecasting total state revenue of $12 billion for fiscal 24 and $15.6 billion for fiscal 25. The unrestricted general fund portion of that was $7 billion for fiscal year 23, and we're forecasting $6.5 billion for fiscal 24 and $6.3 billion for fiscal 25. And before we move on to the next table, did want to proactively address the investment revenues for fiscal year 2024, showing some fairly large declines, in particular in the designated general fund and other restricted categories. And again, that's because those forecasts used actual returns through the end of October, and a lot of those returns were actually negative at that point. If we were to update those forecasts today based on the most recent information, we'd have a much more robust picture of investment revenue for fiscal 24.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the general public, the unrestricted funds in investment revenue from the permanent fund, we passed legislation that limits the draw to 5%. So from a calculation standpoint, how does that number of $3.5 billion equate to that particular piece of legislation?
Sure, Co-Chair Hoffman. So for the permanent fund, we break that revenue into two components, and I have a slide further on that.
Okay, that'll be fine.
Get at that a little bit. I think. All right, so slide 11 takes the same information from the previous slide, but focuses in on just the unrestricted general fund portion, since that's where there's most of the flexibility and discretion around appropriation and budgeting. So investment revenue is one of the two largest sources of unrestricted revenue, estimated to contribute $3.6 billion in fiscal year 2024 and $3.7 billion in fiscal year 2025. Petroleum revenue generated $3.1 billion of unrestricted revenue in fiscal 23 and forecasted $2.4 billion in fiscal 24 and $2.1 billion in fiscal year 2025. And lastly, the various non-petroleum revenue sources are forecasted to contribute about $455 million to unrestricted revenue in fiscal 2024 and $485 million in fiscal year 2025. And then the next few slides will walk through each of these three categories in a little bit more detail. So starting with investment revenue on slide 12. So the permanent fund transfer alone is expected to account for between 49 and 62% of the state's unrestricted revenue over the 10-year forecast. Contributed $3.4 billion in fiscal year 2023 and estimated to contribute $3.5 billion in fiscal year 2024 and $3.7 billion in fiscal year 2025. In addition, there's a small amount of other unrestricted general fund revenue. This represents primarily earnings on the general fund cash balances. That contributed about $98 million in fiscal year 2023 and forecasted to contribute similar, slightly lower amounts for fiscal 24 and 25. And to the earlier question around how we account for the permanent fund earnings, so for the unrestricted general fund revenue that you see here, this represents that 5% of the trailing market value of the first five of the last 6 years of the permanent fund's value. And that's a fairly stable revenue source, that 5% that we show is unrestricted general fund revenue. Any earnings above or below that of the fund, we actually show that as restricted revenue. And so that restricted component of the permanent fund revenue that we show can be more volatile from 1 year to the next.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that that's a very important point, and it would be good to have the five-year average as a calculation, as a slide for the general public to understand. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
Sure. And moving on to slide 13, hopefully we'll help address that question a little bit. That's a little bit more information on the percent of market value transfer in particular. So we have a forecast of what we're expecting that to look like for each of the next 10 years. We're in the official forecast that transfer is expected to be fairly stable at around $3.5 billion per year. These are in real 2024 dollars. In nominal terms, that transfer actually is increasing to about $4.4 billion by the end of the forecast period. These are based on the assumption of the 7.2% annual returns for the fund and the 5% of trailing value calculation. And noting, as I mentioned earlier, we used actual revenue through the end of October in the official forecast calculation. And if we were to update that with the more current information, which is what we'll do for the spring forecast, the transfer would actually be a little bit higher than what was in the official revenue forecast. So what we've done on this slide is we've added two additional lines. We've added a high case and a low case, and these represent, statistically speaking, a 10 percentile probability of how high or low that transfer could be if investment markets were to over or underperform our official forecast.
Are you done with the slide?
Yes.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickley, you talk about a 10 percentile chance, but I look at the low case, and I think last year when we had the Permanent Fund Corporation in here, they were concerned about some scenarios where the earnings reserve ran short. And if memory serves, they had a higher than 1 in 10 chance of that sort of keep you up at night scenario happening. Can you talk to us about your risk assessment on this?
Sure. Senator Keel, through the chair. So this slide is developed assuming that the earnings reserve will be able to pay out the percent of market value in every year. So we're not considering any potential earnings reserve failure for this slide.
Mr. Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, as a follow-up on that, part of the initial concern that was presented about the earnings reserve total balance had to do along with anticipated POMV distributions in future years, along with inflation proofing that would go with it. And so those two draws on that would actually speed up that on the low case, if the low return side, that's where that was. So they did a low, mid, and high as far as an overall risk assessment of the total value of the earnings reserve.
Just to follow up.
Follow up.
Thank you. So if interpolating between the two answers here, it sounds like the Department of Revenue assumes that if the bad thing happens, we'll pause inflation proofing and we'll be okay. Or at least we'll have a 1 in 10 chance of being okay.
Through the chair to Senator Keel, for these numbers, we're just talking about for the POMV draw. So we don't anticipate in our revenue sources book about the inflation proofing aspect for the value of the fund, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Have you had any discussion amongst yourselves about legislation collapsing the POMV into the corpus?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, appreciate the question, sir. It's been an outstanding resolution of the Board of Trustees of the Permanent Fund Corp since 2001, and there was a paper in 2020 addressing that. And so this is a conversation that's been had at the Permanent Fund Corp level as what should be done in order to actually combine the accounts into one account to make sure that there is access to the POMV draw over time. Just to make sure that we're kind of modernizing the principles. There's been a conversation with the governor about that. I don't know where that stands as far as introducing legislation, and I can't speak for the permanent fund as a whole. That would be through the board chair or CEO Mitchell. But it is a conversation that is ongoing as we look at overall risk analysis. I can't say that over the last couple of months, because of how robust the markets were in November and December, it really has actually upticked on the positivity side as far as total fund balances. But I think it's an ongoing conversation we need to keep having, sir.
Thank you.
And for those watching at home, we'll be having the permanent fund come in, and we'll go into the several issues within the permanent fund, including the earnings reserve and sustainability. But on your chart here, it looks like you're using 2.5% inflation. Is that correct going forward?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And then if and the return is 7.2, so if we were to keep our purchasing power constant, what draw rate would that be? 4.7. Correct?
Correct.
Correct. So the point being, I think we need to be cognizant that our draw rate at 5% is above the return rate plus inflation. And we've had those conversations here and concern about that. So at some point, when the consolidation of the fund takes place, we need to take a look at the draw rate, depending on what's going on in the financial markets and stuff. But clearly, from this slide and that analysis of drawing at 5% rate, we're already above the sustained rate of return less inflation. So it makes overdraws of the permanent fund even more dicey. It's something to keep in mind and ask the permanent fund about when we get them here. We'll go ahead and continue.
All right. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle. Moving on to slide 14 and petroleum revenues. So there's four main sources of petroleum revenue. The state levies a property tax on all oil and gas property in the state. That's a fairly stable revenue source, generating a little over $125 million per year. Note that this is only the state's portion of the property tax. There's a municipal tax on the oil and gas property as well that is actually generated $480 million for municipalities in fiscal year 2023 and about $448 million in fiscal year 2022. The state levies a corporate income tax on qualifying corporations doing business in the state. That generated $312 million from oil and gas corporations in fiscal 23, and we're forecasting $240 million in fiscal 24 and $300 million in fiscal year 2025. The oil and gas production tax, that's the state's severance tax on petroleum. For North Slope production, it consists of a net profits tax with a gross minimum tax floor and certain tax credits that can apply primarily against the net profits portion of that tax. At current prices, we are forecasting that some, but not all, companies will be paying above the tax floor. And the production tax is expected to bring in around $938 million in the current fiscal year and then about $642 million in fiscal year 2025. Royalties from oil and gas production on state land brought in about $1.2 billion in fiscal year 2023. We're forecasting around $1.1 billion in fiscal 24 and around $1 billion in fiscal year 2025. In addition to these unrestricted general fund portion of the royalties, there's also a significant royalty revenue that we consider restricted. This includes the portion of royalty revenue that is deposited into the permanent fund as well as the school fund. And then later in the presentation, we have some detailed walkthrough of some of the key assumptions that underlie these petroleum revenue forecasts.
So is now the time to talk about the production tax, the 642 and the per barrel credit differentiation, or do you want to do that later in this, in your slide deck?
Mr. Chairman, at your pleasure, happy to discuss it now, or we can save it for the after the petroleum if you'd prefer.
Save it for the what?
We could circle back to it after we go through the petroleum revenue.
That's fine.
Assumptions.
That's fine.
Just might provide
sure
a little bit more context to
the
discussion.
Yes, that's fine. I just want to make sure we cover it. Go ahead.
So slide 15 shows some additional detail on the non-petroleum revenue forecast. The largest portion of the unrestricted non-petroleum revenue is taxes, and typically the corporate income tax is the largest portion of that. Corporate income taxes from non-petroleum corporations generated around $124 million in fiscal year 2023. And we're forecasting $130 million for fiscal 24 and $160 million for fiscal year 2025. And that increase from the non-petroleum corporate income tax, we're actually expecting that trend to continue beyond fiscal year 2025. That's a fairly broad-based assumption based on general economic growth as well as recovery from sectors like mining and tourism. Other significant taxes include the mining license tax, insurance premium tax, fisheries taxes, and excise taxes. And then in addition to taxes, we have other non-petroleum revenues. These include a variety of things like licenses and permits, fines and forfeitures, charges for services, and dividends from state-owned corporations. So now for the last section of the presentation, we'll walk through some of the key assumptions for the petroleum revenue forecast in particular. Starting with the oil price forecast on slide 17. So this shows our 10-year oil price forecast from the fall forecast, as well as a comparison to the previous forecast. We utilize futures market projections for as many years as are available. For the forecast, so for this fall forecast, we use futures market projections through fiscal year 2032, and then beyond that, we assume that there would be an inflation adjustment to oil prices for the very long term. We generated our fall price forecast on December 8th using prices from the first five trading days in December, so it was a fairly quick turnaround from the December 8th, where we set the price forecast, to the 14th, when we released the revenue sources book. And again, our fall forecast represents an increase to the FY fiscal year 2024 price of a little over $9 per barrel, about a $6 per barrel increase for fiscal year 2025. And then as we get later into the revenue forecast, there was price forecast was increased by a smaller amount and actually came even with the spring forecast towards the end of the forecast period there.
Maybe we can just stop there just for a second. We're going to be asking legislative finance to run our budgets on $60 a barrel oil because we've been the industry seems to, or the financial industry seems to use $60 a barrel when they look at the oil and gas industry around Alaska and other areas in the country. So we want to see what our budget looks like at 60. So just as a heads up, to run it at 60, 65, 70, and then your projections. And that'll be future discussions, because we want to get a good feel for our sensitivity of our net or deficit as we go forward.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. And we actually, in the revenue sources book in Appendix A1, we have a sensitivity analysis table for three fiscal years, and we have a more robust 10-year version of that that we provide to legislative finance, and we'd be happy to provide that to the committee as well.
Yes, because we're going to be looking out 2-3 years, not going to spend a lot of time on 10 years. And we'll wait until we get a better idea of our budget, and we'll probably need the February 14th date to pass so we actually see what the governor submits and changes and what is left out of the budget so we can get a better delineation of what our expenditures actually are. So it'll be coming in a little later, but we need to do that exercise again.
So slide 18, this is a chart that we actually, we do have an updated version of this that we updated yesterday that we'd be happy to provide to the committee, but the picture is fairly similar. But what this slide shows is how our oil price forecast compares to different sources. We compare to price forecasts from the U.S. Energy Information Agency, the most recent futures market data, and an average of analyst forecasts. Our forecast is generally in line with other sources, and actually looking at the most recent version of this slide, it's actually even a more tighter band than what's shown up here on the screen. In general, the different sources suggest a most likely price range in the $70 to $80 per barrel price range over the long term, and that is kind of where our forecast falls in line. And actually, the current futures market outlook for the next couple of years is within a dollar of our revenue forecast as of yesterday, so looking in line for the right now. And slide nine.
Mr. Sticker, we'll expect you then to be within a dollar 1 year from now when we review your forecast.
I'll do my best.
Okay. We have confidence.
And just in case we're not within a dollar, we've prepared this slide 19, and this is based on those sensitivity tables I was talking about earlier. This shows how unrestricted revenue would change if oil prices were higher or lower than our revenue forecast. And near the revenue forecast of $76 per barrel, a $1 increase or decrease of oil price represents around a $45 to $50 million change in unrestricted general fund revenue. Given that we have a progressive fiscal system, once you're at higher prices, closer to $100 per barrel, that metric goes up to around $75 million per dollar change of oil prices. And once you're at a lower oil price, around $50 per barrel, that metric goes down to about $25 million per dollar of oil price change.
So is there things in play in these calculations that have changed that over the last couple of years? As I recall, in the price arena we're in now, it would have been somewhere in the 70 range. And there's other things going on in the expenditure side that's, I think, altering that.
Sure. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. So one of the changes, comparing to our prior forecast, the production forecast, as you heard yesterday, has been decreased a little bit. The more significant change is that we are forecasting significantly higher company spending. or lease expenditures. And so that impacts kind of the threshold where companies are going between the minimum tax floor and the net profits tax. And so that does change. It changes kind of where these transitions between different between the gross minimum floor and the net profits tax. And so, yes, that is a change that we've made this forecast.
And we had a question on this side of the table. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, do you have a hard, fast list at your tax division on what are approved allowable deductions for CapEx for North Slope?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, we have detailed statutory guidance and regulations that support that as well, and we'd be happy to provide that.
I'd like to see that, please. If the chair would allow that.
I think, isn't it generally what's allowable by the IRS as a CapEx expenditure versus an operating expenditure?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So generally for the lease expenditures, we do follow IRS guidance, but then we have a specific set of over a dozen exclusions of what is not an allowable expenditure, and then we have regulations to support that as well.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So slide 20 is kind of a reiteration of what you heard from Department of Natural Resources yesterday. This shows the forecast for North Slope oil production. We've also added a high and a low case for the next 10 years. Again, over fiscal year 2024 through 2026, the general story is fairly stable production, a little under that 500,000 barrel per day number, and that stability is a combination of natural declines in the mature fields, offset by additional drilling in those fields. And then once we get into 2027 and beyond, that trend of the natural decline and the additional drilling is overlaid by new production coming out of new developments. Pikka and Willow in particular on a risk basis added to our production forecast here. And slide 21 is showing how that forecast changed from the prior spring forecast. So the forecast was reduced for fiscal year 2024, 2025, and 2026, and then increased for 2027 and beyond based on the increased confidence in new fields like Pikka and Willow.
So in FY 25 is what we're looking at here in our upcoming budget and the rest of this year. How much of that decline is implicit in Prudhoe Bay?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but we'd be happy to provide a breakout by field or general area.
That would be helpful, at least through 25.
All right, and slide 22 shows how allowable lease expenditures for the North Slope have changed over the past couple of years, and then our 10-year forecast for both capital and operating expenditures. These are an important measure of planned investment in Alaska, and they're also important because the lease expenditures are deductible in the production tax calculation. So in fiscal year 2023, North Slope capital expenditures were $2.6 billion and $2.3 billion and operating expenditures were $2.6 billion. And both of these represented a rebound from the past couple of years where oil prices had been lower and COVID impacts had led to reduced activity. So a pretty significant rebound in 2023, and we are expecting a large jump over the next couple of years as companies increase and continue drilling at existing fields and then make major investments in new fields. So we're forecasting capital expenditures to exceed $4 billion in fiscal year 25 and 2026. And then to stabilize long-term, once after those new fields like the Pica and Willow are online, we're forecasting capital expenditures to stabilize at just under $3 billion per year. On the operating expenses side, companies pulled back as much as they could during COVID, but we are seeing some return to some pressures to increased operating costs based on inflation and other factors, and then we also overlay the cost of operating the new units that are being developed.
So the unallowable, are you done with the slide?
Sure.
The unallowable lease expenditures or the carry forwards, or what do they look like?
So, Mr. Chairman, this slide here, the allowable lease expenditures, this is all lease expenditures that we allow for tax purposes. So a portion of these would be applied against a tax liability in calculating production tax. And then a portion of these allowable lease expenditures, if a company does not have sufficient liability, a portion of them would generate a carried forward lease expenditure that could offset future production tax liabilities. But these numbers do represent all lease expenditures that we allow for tax purposes.
Okay, and then are you going to touch on the carry forward credit accumulation? Or?
Sure, we can. I don't have a specific slide for that, but I can throw out some numbers here. I'm looking at table 8.4 of the revenue sources book. And we do have a number on line 23 of that table where we enumerate the tax value of any of those carried forward annual losses, as well as any other outstanding credits held by the companies. At the end of fiscal 2023, that tax value was estimated at $334 million. And we're expecting that to grow to $1.2 billion by the end of fiscal year 2025. And almost $2 billion by the end of the forecast period.
And then I think we're going to need some help tracking that and watching that as it flows against the current year revenue, whatever year we're working on here at the table, because it does get confusing. We have the reoccurring expenditures in any given year, but then we've got the carry forward credits that are going to come against the revenue stream in that given year. So we need to keep an eye on the accumulation of those and then how they flow in each year so there's no confusion.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And the primarily those carried forward lease expenditures are being earned by primarily companies that are not yet in production and developing, doing exploration or development of new fields in Alaska. And then those carried forward lease expenditures would be able to be used to offset, potentially offset future tax liabilities once those companies come into production.
And then you want to add the ones that do have revenue, how that works?
Sure. There's kind of this this donut hole situation is what we call it. So for a company that has sufficient current revenue and sufficient current production to be paying above the minimum tax floor, they are able to use all allowable lease expenditures to reduce their production tax value, which is the subject of the net profits tax. And then a company with no production tax value is able to earn a carried forward lease expenditure to offset a future tax liability. And then there's this area in between, and we do have companies that are currently in this situation where you have a positive production tax value, so you are making money in the state, but you're paying at the minimum tax floor. There's actually an area in the tax calculation we call the donut hole where the company is not getting any benefit for those lease expenditures.
And then is this,
guess we're into this. I keep asking this. On the per barrel credit, when are we going to roll in that conversation? When does it fit in your presentation?
Happy to jump into it now if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And the reason I ask is when we look at our revenue and our revenue forecasts, we in the legislature and the public use a revenue sources book, and it's accumulation of multiple companies, and they're all commingled and compressed into like there's one entity in the state, pretty much on the North Slope. So it makes it very difficult when we look at the revenue source book to try to bifurcate actually what's going on. And when we run our calculations on what per barrel credit should be accumulating at this particular price range at $8 per barrel, it looks like it comes into somewhere around $1 billion on the $8 credit. But in the revenue source book, there's a little over $600 million deduct. So there's about $370 million floating around out there that we can't account for with the information that we have publicly available. So you could, so I'd like you to help us understand why in FY25, the per barrel credits, I could open my book and look and get the exact number, north of 600 versus around a billion.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So it helps to kind of walk through a little bit about how the production tax calculation works. So in general, a company takes their Alaska North Slope oil price at market, deducts cost of getting the oil to market to arrive at a gross value at point of production. And then allowable lease expenditures are deducted from that gross value to create a net value or production tax value. And that's the value to which the production tax is applied at the 35% rate. And then certain tax credits can offset that net production tax value. Companies are able to use per taxable barrel credits for non-gross value reduction oil to reduce their tax liability down to a minimum tax floor, and the minimum tax floor is 4% of gross value. So depending on their specific tax calculation, some companies are able to use per taxable barrel credits to reduce their tax calculation to the minimum tax floor. Some may choose to forego sliding scale per taxable barrel credits and use other credits, such as credits for gross value reduction eligible oil, to reduce their tax below the minimum tax floor. So for fiscal year 2025, if you're just looking at aggregate data, you're correct. There would be an estimated $1.2 billion of per taxable barrel credits generated. And in the aggregate, if you do a calculation, we would expect that those credits would reduce tax revenue to the state down to the minimum tax floor. However, there is not just one single company. There's multiple companies. We have several major producers and several smaller producers. And each of those companies has a very different situation around their activity in Alaska in terms of fields they operate in and investments that they're choosing to make in the state. So in the fall forecast, some of the companies are paying above the minimum tax floor, so they're able to use all of their generated per taxable barrel credits to reduce their tax liability, and they're still paying above the minimum tax floor. We have other companies that are expected to be paying at the minimum tax floor. So they're able to use only a portion of their per taxable barrel credits to reduce their net tax down to the minimum tax floor. Or in some cases, they're not able to use any per taxable barrel credits at all. And so it's the amalgamation of all of these individual company-specific calculations that we do that results in only $678 million of the $1.2 billion of per taxable barrel credits generated. Only that $678 million of those are actually applied against the tax liability. And when you're looking at the fiscal year 2025 revenue forecast, for example, you end up with a higher production tax calculation based on the company's specific modeling than if you were doing an aggregate calculation.
Okay, so we'll have to think about that a bit and try to figure out how we're going to relay that information into the revenue source book so people understand it as we, you know, move forward in time. And just for those watching at home, the revenue source book is kind of a live document. There's always things being added and subtracted and clarified and what have you. But I think that's an important issue because it's to the point where you can't, from the publicly available information, really get a grasp of what's going on because of the complexity of our tax structure.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And yeah, we'd be happy to look at options for adding as much clarity as we can around that issue.
Yeah. Might be a giant footnote. Okay, go ahead and continue.
All righty. Moving on to slide 23. So this slide shows a history and forecast for transportation costs. These are important to look at because they reduce the value of oil for both production tax and royalty calculation purposes. The transportation costs include all of the costs of getting oil to market. The two biggest components are marine transportation costs, or the tanker to get from Valdez to markets primarily in the West Coast, and then the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Tariff. Some of the other transportation costs include the feeder pipeline tariffs up on the North Slope, and then other minor adjustments for Quality Bank and other things. So for fiscal year 2023, the average transportation cost was $9.61 per barrel, and we're forecasting $10.75 per barrel for both fiscal 24 and fiscal 25. And then for the transportation cost to stabilize around $10 per barrel for the remainder of the forecast period. The increase from fiscal 23 to fiscal 2024 is primarily due to higher marine transportation costs. We saw those costs increase as a result of both higher operating costs, which is kind of the inflation impacts, as well as higher fuel costs. We are forecasting that those marine costs will stabilize over the remainder of the forecast period. And then looking at the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Tariff and some of the feeder pipeline tariffs, we're actually forecasting those values to decrease slightly in the later years. And that's an impact of new production coming online from the new fields like Pica and Willow. And when you have more production going through a pipeline, it reduces the cost of operating that pipeline on a per barrel basis. So if we were looking at flat or declining production, this picture would look very different.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stickle, but that also would equate in those years 29 and 30, you should see a smidgen of increased revenue to the state with those lower transportation costs.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, so since these transportation costs are factored into both the production tax and royalty calculations, yes, they do directly increase state revenue.
Thank you.
And slide 24 is the good news in the presentation. Looking at tax credits. So prior to fiscal year 2016, we had various tax credits in place in statute. And those tax credits could be either applied against tax liability or turned into a tax credit certificate. And the state could then purchase those tax credit certificates at face value. Up until fiscal year 2016, the legislature funded and the governor let stand the full amount of eligible tax credits each year to be purchased. When the state budget issues intensified, fiscal year 2016 was the first year that less than the full amount of outstanding tax credits was purchased. In 2016 and 2017, the legislature made statutory changes that eventually phased out the ability to earn new credits that were available for state purchase, but there was still a large outstanding balance of those credits. And in fiscal years 20 and 21, no appropriation was made for tax credit certificates. But then the last few years in fiscal years 22, 23, and 24, in those budgets, appropriations were made to purchase these outstanding tax credits. And between that and some transfers between companies, we were able to fully retire all the outstanding tax credits in fiscal year 2024. There is one outstanding appeal before the Supreme Court that could result in a very small future appropriation were we to lose that appeal. But otherwise, no future appropriations are needed, and this liability of the state is completely taken care of.
Mr. Commissioner.
Yeah, for the record, Commissioner Crum, I'd just like to say thank you to the legislature for working with the governor's office the last couple of years for this concerted effort to pay this down. This is a conversation that comes up in our meetings with credit rating agencies and banks of getting these outstanding liabilities down off the books. And just to be able to move on from this phase as we look towards how we're going to do budget into the future on these future projects. But those are big dollar amounts of the last couple of years that were directly appropriated to end this process. I just appreciate the effort of the legislature doing so.
Senator Bishop and Senator Hoffman.
I'm going to yield to Senator Hoffman because I think I know what he's going to say.
Hey, Hoffman, then Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have the number readily available of how much we paid on the tax credits cumulatively? If not, can you provide that information to me?
Co-Chair Hoffman, I will be happy to provide it. I know it's north of $3
billion. $3 billion. Thank you.
That wasn't monopoly money, though. $3 billion in
real money.
Real money. Senator Bishop.
That's my question.
And then when you get back, break, if you could break down what credits they were. There might be several different credits. You know, if you're going to give us the $3 million total, kind of break it down. In fact, I think it's in your book, but yeah, you could put it in the answers to the committee would be helpful.
Absolutely. And I was going to point out, Mr. Chairman, Table 8-4 has a 10-year history. And so it's just a matter of providing a few additional historical years and then adding up the numbers, and we'll be happy to provide that.
Okay. And also, could you include then Cook Inlet and a breakout also, because that was the other section?
Absolutely.
So somebody doesn't ask that, and you have to go back and redo the data.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It may be out of your realm, but in the viewpoint of the administration, was this a valued experiment that was positive to the state of Alaska?
That's a commissioner question.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. That's a good question. It brought a different level of attention to the state. Over time, we actually got different attention from different producers and other folks involved throughout the process. Because of the budget issues we did have and the inconsistency of the payment of the credits, it's actually hard to quantify what that was. If it was a consistent payout over time and the value, would we see different situations, particularly like Cook Inlet, with some of those agencies who had to sell pennies on the dollar the value of those credits? So it's an interesting question. I think that as we look forward at that, some of the issues we have in Cook Inlet, some of the issues we have across North Slope to continue making sure we have production, what is that overall value is something that we're working to quantify, and it's a difficult conversation that has to really take place in current markets and the current situations we're in. Doing it over a long period of time, there's a lot of disruption that occurred, and I think from my perspective, from the Department of Revenue, we're glad to have this off the books going forward as we can look at other items and not having to track this over time. I think it'd be interesting to put this together in the cumulative for you, both in the real dollars and the nominal dollars, to see what the overall value of that was versus the revenue that was brought into the state.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. And the $3 billion in credits, did that include Cook Inlet, or was that excluding Cook Inlet? And if it excluded Cook Inlet, what was the credits for Cook Inlet?
Sure, Co-Chair Hoffman. So we actually have some information that we've put together last session. We'd be happy to update that and provide it that provides those cumulative numbers. And then also we have some information correlating what we got for that activity. And so we'd be happy to provide that.
So you're telling me, Mr. Chairman, that the $3 billion does not include the credits for Cook Inlet?
I believe that was... I was looking at a number, and it was north of $3 billion. I believe it was a cumulative number, but we'll provide the breakout for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, we're going to have you back in a couple of days anyway to go over the answers. That'll be a good time to go over that. But I think the point that you brought up about a historical review, when you have time, would be good to do, because there is some positives and there is some negatives on this. So in the event that future generations want to repeat some of the policies, to repeat the positive ones and not the ones that didn't work so well would be, I think, beneficial. Because we have a tendency of repeating things sometimes that don't work. Senator Bishop.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Mr. Chairman. And you won't know for another 8 years on some of these credits. But I'd just like to say, it'd be nice. I mean, it's done. The deal is done. It's paid. But I'd just like to recognize at this table, at one time, it was in 2017 or 2018, we voted to pay off all the credits in one lump sum.
We have any more slides or questions? No, I think that's your last slide, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's the last major slide. I have a couple of appendix slides for the benefit of the committee. Be happy sure. to walk through those or yep. leave them for you. Sure. So slide 27 is a slide that we like to include. This shows how state petroleum revenues vary by land type. And with some of the major new fields coming online, this is a significant concept. So production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax, those apply everywhere in the state, except for federal waters beyond 3 miles offshore, regardless of land ownership. And then on the royalty side of things, the royalty rates vary significantly by land ownership. So state royalty applies on state lands, but then on, for instance, on National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, it's a federal royalty that applies, and half of those royalties are shared back to the state. But then they have to be used for the benefit of specific municipalities. So just like to provide this for the benefit of the committee.
So all oil is not equal?
Correct.
That's important to remember. That's equal in revenue to the state. Senator Bishop.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dickel, can you explain, just give me I forgot, other federal lands, 90% back to the state. What are those?
So, Senator Bishop, through the chair, so this would be kind of more theoretical. So for federal land in federal law, the National Petroleum Reserve is specifically carved out with special provisions around how production there, those royalties are shared. And then Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, that's also specifically carved out. So the other federal land would be any, if there were to be oil production from federal land outside of ANWR and NPRA, how would that be shared with the state potentially?
Thank you. And for historical purposes, wasn't ANWR 90-10 for a long time? And then it was, when it was approved under the Trump administration, it went to 50-50. Am I correct or not?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, that's correct. So ANWR was not specifically carved out, so it would have been the 90% share back to the state with no restrictions. And as part of the negotiation to allow the leasing in ANWR, that was changed to a 50% share.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle.
All right. And then slide 28 is the same information as one of our previous slides on the changes to the production forecast, just zoomed in to show for scale and time horizon, and shows how the forecast was for production was decreased for the next 3 years. And then slide 29 is, again, similar information to one of our previous slides. This includes additional historical years of data, as well as oil and gas employment are included on this slide. And you can see historically there's been a positive correlation between investment and jobs in the oil industry. And so with the significant increases in investment that we're seeing, it would be reasonable to expect increases in employment in coming years. And I think the recent forecast out of Department of Labor reflects that as well.
So is there any guesstimate on when we would return to pre-COVID, the 18, 19, 20 employment?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer specific questions on that to Department of Labor. They have a team that actively forecasts the employment. From our perspective at Department of Revenue, we can speak directionally. So directionally, the jobs appear to be moving in the upward direction.
So, and we can get that from the Department of Labor. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stickle, this one may also be a Department of Labor question because it doesn't make the first nickel's difference to the state budget, but what does the Alaskan employment trend line look like here?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I would not have that information off the top of my head.
Mr. Commissioner.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I'd like to know this because we presented to it to Banks last week. So in the December trends article in the calendar year 23, there was 2.6% employment growth in the state of Alaska, and our GDP went up 4.6%.
And just to follow up, Commissioner, do you know if that is the same on these North Slope jobs?
On the North Slope jobs in particular, I don't know that breakout through the chair. I apologize.
We can have that question fired off to the Department of Labor. It would be good to keep track of because we're all looking forward to getting COVID behind us completely.
And then the final appendix slide that we included was slide 30. This is, again, similar information from one of our previous slides, just with a longer time horizon. And what you see here is that there was a pretty substantial decrease in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff from 2014 through, say, 2019. That had to do with some efficiency measures, some cost cutting, some new tariff settlements on the pipeline that caused the TAPS tariff to increase over that time period.
Any final comments or questions for the Commissioner and Mr. Stickle? Seeing none, any final comments, Mr. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the opportunity to come here today, even from the investment account perspective, which we'll go in more detail tomorrow. The numbers have changed quite a bit. The financial markets are a little unstable, but as we look at this, we continue to monitor the oil forecast going forward. We have worked at Department of Revenue to partner with Department of Natural Resources to make sure that we're presenting and talking about the same production forecasts over time, as well as predictability on the numbers we use, which is why we're using the first five trading days of December for the forecast. We're trying to, as opposed to cherry-picking dates or waiting and hoping for good news, we're trying to get much more defined time periods for numbers that are presented, knowing that the futures change over time, but it's a pragmatic, defensible approach as we present numbers to you so we have time frames that we can work off of together.
Right, because we want to be able to rely on the Department of Revenue. We don't want to have to do it ourselves. It works a lot better that way. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and thank the department for coming forward. We look forward to your answers and may even be a few more questions, you know, when we put our little mosaic together. And then we'll have you back sometime in the near future, other than these questions, answer these questions, but to keep us tuned up on the revenue side, because I think the budget is going to be tighter this year than last year. So we're going to have to pay fairly close attention to that to make sure we can help push the financial rating of the state up instead of down, and meet our obligations, including our dividends and our services to our citizens. So that concludes the meeting today. Tomorrow, 9 a.m., we're going to go over the savings, the reserves, which are cash positions and investment funds with the Department of Revenue, it says here. So we'll see you tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We are adjourned.